Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Diplomatic blah, blah, blah. Hi, everybody. You're listening to the Tamar Yonah Show here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Well, Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett went to go visit Vladimir Putin in Russia just over the weekend, just before the weekend, I should say. According to Arut Sheva, IsraelNationalNews.com, Putin was very attentive to Israel's concerns. The prime minister returns from Sochi, describes four-hour meeting with Russian president in Sochi to cabinet. I hope I pronounced the name of that city correctly. But, you know, there are tensions between Russia and Israel. We're going to discuss that because Russia is for the Iran deal. And how does that work with Israel's relationship with Russia? And why is Israel meeting with Russia in the first place? Well, I can take a guess. I'll hear what our guest has to say today. But I would think that with America and how it treated its ally Afghanistan and how Afghanis, even American citizens in Afghanistan, couldn't rely on the White House to protect them and have their backs, I think that other allies of the United States today also are not believing that America has their backs as well. So they're looking to China, they're looking to Russia, they're looking to other places to cozy up to have relations with, just in case, you know. Anyway, by the way, I was on a very interesting video interview this last week with... actually, the last week or two, with Dr. Volodymyr Zelenko, who has the Zelenko protocol for COVID, and also with Rabbi Hananya Weissman. You might want to go to my Facebook page, and you'll see the video there. If you want to go and see it, you can leave a comment on the Rumble page where it is posted. All right, we're also going to be talking today about China and Turkey and the fake NGOs just outlawed. I have no idea what that's about, but our guest does, and he's going to inform us about it. So don't go anywhere, everybody. We're going to be right back.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. We're talking about diplomatic blah, blah, blah. And there was a meeting between Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and Vladimir Putin from Russia. According to our Arut Sheva headline, it says here, Putin was very attentive to Israel's concerns. I would have preferred to see a title like Putin says he is, has Israel's back, or we have a new friend, or cooperation, even though you really can't rely on anybody. It still would have been a lot more warmer than he was attentive to Israel's concerns. That sounds almost patronizing to me. The meeting, they say, was between 4 to 5 hours long. And it took place in Sochi, Russia. I hope I pronounced the name Sochi right, correctly. Apologies if I didn't. And our guest today to tell us about this and more things of what's happening in China, Turkey, etc., we're going to be speaking with Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem. He is a researcher, former lecturer at Ben-Gurion University. He's authored over 80 books and 400 research papers on science, history, and more. He commentates on Mideast and world issues. I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem.
Thank you.
All right. So in a nutshell, maybe you can give us a little bit of an idea what the papers, the media, is saying, what this meeting was about between Putin and Naftali Bennett.
Well, basically the media says nothing. You expect it beautifully by saying blah, blah, blah. We have no real reports from any media outlet that I've been able to find on what the content of these talks were. What we can say is that any meeting between heads of state that lasts for somewhere between 4 to 5 hours, perhaps even longer, because we have various reports, can't be trivial. So there is some substance there, but we don't know what the substance is.
All right. So for all of our listeners, Naftali Bennett did meet with Putin. Also, he brought with one of his ministers, Zev Elkin, who, by the way, is a Russian originally. So he speaks Russian. And he brought him with him. And there was a joke, apparently, going around the media because Zev Elkin was carrying some type of case with him into the meeting, and they're all wondering what was in this case, what was in this case, and he came out and he said it was maps. They were most likely aerial maps, and we do see in the press that there has been targeted attacks in Syria. The media, I'm not sure if the Israeli government admits to being the one that's doing these bombings. I'm not sure if they are or aren't. But it's assumed that Israel's doing it because of its defense, because Syria is a tentacle of Iran, and Iran is encroaching onto Israel's border through Syria. So with all of this, and you were saying that the Ma'ariv newspaper or media came out with an article saying that the meeting was a failure, Mordechai. So with all of this, what do you come out with?
Well, I should, a mild correction. The article that I found from Ma'ariv said the meeting will be a failure.
Oh, will be a failure.
Yeah, it was before the meeting.
Ah, okay, okay.
I haven't found any articles that were after the meeting that actually gave any substance. I found two articles that mention it. Both of them were basically empty of any facts. And they disagreed with empty of any facts and disagreed with one another, which is quite an accomplishment, actually.
So it was a very mysterious meeting, at least to the media.
Let me address what you said about Elkin. Elkin is there, as you said, because he's fluent in Russian. But that case that he carried, it's traditional, I should say, in sort of in double quotation marks, that when our prime ministers meet with Putin, and as everyone knows, Putin and Netanyahu had a very personal relationship. And, of course, personal relationships take a great deal of time to create.
Yes.
And so it's clear that he doesn't have any such relationship with Bennett. From nobody's fault of that. I mean, Bennett simply knew it's a job. But it's been traditional all through the years that when we meet with Mr. Putin, we bring him facts. Putin is a
strategist,
a very practical man. He knows he wants to see what we know. He wants to see what we can tell him. He wants to learn. He's very, very far from stupid. He's clearly one of the sharpest leaders on the planet at this time.
Right. Wasn't he formerly the head of the KGB or in the KGB?
No, he was a member of the KGB.
Okay.
At some level. We don't really know exactly what he did there, but he was trained at the KGB and was formerly a part of the KGB. But, I mean, that was a very long time ago.
But he could tell us, but then he'd have to kill us.
He's a person that deals with facts. He doesn't deal with just talk.
Okay.
And so I would imagine, and of course I don't have facts here. This is a supposition. I would imagine that what Elkin was carrying was indeed documents, and these documents probably included maps and aerial photographs, and et cetera, and details, facts were presented to him as part of the discussion. which is a very natural thing to do and a very normal thing to do. And so there's nothing special about that. But I would imagine that was probably a great deal of the time simply looking at real facts on the ground, in this case, probably literally on the ground, in terms of Syria, in terms of Iran. Remember, Russia today considers itself an ally of Syria, and therefore, remember the order here, and therefore supports Assad. He does not support Assad and therefore Syria. He supports Syria and therefore Assad. He does not consider himself to be an ally of Iran, but an associate of Iran. So if Iran wants to come and buy, for instance, weapon systems from Russia, Russia will consider it. It's not something that's obvious to Russia. Russia likes to make money like anybody else. So they will consider selling arms to Iran, just like they will consider selling arms to almost anyone else. But they do not consider themselves to be an ally of Iran, and Iran does not consider them to be an ally to be an ally.
Right. Russia is for the Iran deal.
Sorry?
And yet Russia is for the Iran deal.
Russia is for the Iran deal for political reasons. Remember, one of the primary motivations for everything that Russia does for the past decade at least is to do anything possible to annoy and inhibit the United States.
But the United States is pushing the Iran deal. So how's that annoying the United States?
Well, Putin is a lot smarter than either Biden or Blinken, and Putin is aware that the Iran deal is a crappy deal. It's basically BS.
Then why is Israel so much against it?
Oh, because it's basically BS. it's a bad deal. It's a bad deal for everybody. The deal basically says that once 10 years have passed, and they're nearly over now, Iran can do anything it bloody well pleases. It doesn't have to tell anybody anything, or it doesn't have to do anything that anybody says. And so Iranians love it. The American maladministration, both the Obama and the Biden maladministrations, love it because it allows Iran to do whatever it bloody well pleases, and that's what they want. And Israel is against it because it allows Iran to do whatever it bloody well pleases. Putin makes a very basic assumption here. Many times in the past, over the past hundreds of years, when Persia, or whatever you want to call it, the president of the iteration is called Iran, did something which was stupid, Russia went in and beat the living daylights out of them more than once. And so Russia's probably assuming if they actually get nuclear weapons and threaten anybody, they'll go in and beat the living daylights out of them again.
I don't know. It would seem to me that any...
on the border, it's easy for Russia to do that.
I understand, but it would seem to me that any non-Muslim country would want to see Iran incapable of developing nuclear weapons. I mean, it's crazy to let them this country have nuclear weapons.
You're speaking as a Westerner and as a Jew and as an Israeli, and so your viewpoint is legitimate, but it's not necessarily the viewpoint of, for instance, China or Russia.
Why would China and Russia want Iran to have nuclear weapons?
You're misphrasing it. I didn't say that they would want them. I would say that they don't view that as being something catastrophic.
Why?
Because they figure they can just go in and take them away if they want.
But to have to go to war with a country that's a nuclear country or a country that's not a nuclear country is a night and day. Even if you have nukes.
Not necessarily. Remember, everybody tends to think in terms of black and white. It's not black and white. Once Iran gets the first nuclear weapon, it'll be small, it'll be primitive, it'll be like the ones that America dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The delivery systems will take another 10 to 20 years before they're of any real danger to anyone outside the region. In other words, they'll be a danger to the region, not to anybody outside the region. They won't be a danger to Russia or China. They will be a danger to Europe because they can be smuggled.
All right, so we have to take a break. When we get back, we're going to be continuing this and also talking about China and Turkey. We need to know what's going on and not have our heads in the sand just because we're in a different part of the world. We're one global world. We'll be right back.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. We are live, so if you have a comment or a question you want to call in, you can call us. Our numbers are on the top of our homepage at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. At the top of the page are our phone numbers. We are live if you're listening on Sunday afternoon from 4 to 5 p.m. Holy time right here in the land of Israel, or if it's between 9 to 10 a.m. on Sunday morning in the Eastern time zone, that means that we are live. There's a seven-hour difference between New York and Israel, so 9 a.m. New York time and 4 p.m. Israel time. We are talking with Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem. He commentates on Mideast and world issues, and he's here talking to us about the big news story here in Israel, and that is just on the heels of the meeting between Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. And some people are saying that the meeting, they predicted it to be a failure. A lot is a mystery what went on there. My question to you, aside from the meeting, since we know so little, Mordechai, is why is Russia still in Syria? They went in there in the first place because Bashar Assad needed help from his civil war. It looks more or less stable now after so many years of being on the brink where he may have had to flee for his life. And Russia is still there. Tell our listeners why.
Well, first of all, Russia did not go in there because Assad was falling.
That was their excuse to go in there.
That's a false perception.
They wanted
Russia
the warm
for a very
water
simple reason.
Ports.
It's a time of Peter the Great, and even more so Catherine the Great. Russia has recognized a strong need for them to have warm water ports, and that's what they're doing in Syria today. That's what they're doing. They've been doing in Syria all along. They have Latakia. That's what's important to them. They have a major naval base, a major air base. In other words, they are. That is their primary extension of Russian power. And it is probably the most important extension of its kind outside of Russia itself.
Okay, so we're establishing that they're there because they want the warm water ports for their ships because it gets very cold in Russia. And if the ports there freeze over, become ice, they can't do their shipping. So they're down there now in Syria, which is on the Mediterranean Sea. All right, so we've established that. Let's go now and turn to another country that's also bordering Russia and the Black Sea there that divides these two nations, and that is Turkey, which also used to be a world power with the Ottoman Empire. Turkey and the NGOs, the non-governmental... Help me.
Organizations.
I need a cup of coffee. Tell our listeners what that's all about.
Okay. First of all, let's just briefly recall what the news item is. The news item was that our Minister of Defense declared six NGOs to be terrorist organizations or strongly affiliated with terrorist organizations, and the European media immediately went nuts. How can you declare charitable organizations to be terrorist affiliated? Oh, what a horrible thing to say, blah, blah, blah. They were totally wrong. He was partially right, partially in the sense that he only declared six to be affiliated. Number is probably closer to 600. Turkey has for the past perhaps 10 years, maybe even more, been constantly creating tens and tens and hundreds of NGOs throughout Jerusalem, throughout Gaza, through all over the areas which they use as front organizations for many and various things. Most of them are disguised as charitable organizations, but in reality, these are the organizations via which Turkey funds Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Palestine Liberation Organization, PFLP, etc., etc., etc.
Okay, wait. I have to stop you here because I need you to tell us why Turkey would be supporting these terrorist organizations.
Because Turkey is a terrorist state. Turkey has been for many years now. It did not begin that way. Turkey used to be a very normal, a very
Western
good place.
Friendly. Yeah.
But since Erdogan took over, his first few years, he maintained Turkey as it was before, and he was very successful economically, diplomatically. He did some very nice things for Turkey in the beginning. But after a while, he changed, and his party and he himself became Islamist, and they get increasingly radical as time goes on. And today, Turkey is a radical Sunni terrorist state that strongly supports all of these various terrorist organizations, whether you talk about Al-Qaeda, Hamas, ISIS, and etc., etc. All of these are supported today by Turkey, actively supported with funding, with weapons, training, with logistics, and etc., etc.
Okay, and so do you think this is because he became a much more religious Muslim, or are there other reasons, political reasons?
I think that's a very good question. I don't really have an answer. I doubt that he suddenly became more religious. I just simply don't see any evidence of that. I think he was always of these views. I think he became more confident in his own abilities to do things in certain ways, and also to hide these things. And I think that primarily happened as a result of the, I'm going to call it a false flag coup d'etat that was attempted a few years ago in Turkey. I believe it was attempted. We don't have strong evidence who actually did it. I believe it was actually a false flag engineered by him and his party.
Right, because he wanted to take out his opponents.
Correct.
Okay.
That's my belief. Again, I'm emphasizing I don't have strong facts behind that, but I think there's ample circumstantial evidence to support that view. And I think he allowed himself and his government to be strongly radicalized as a result of that, meaning that when he saw that he could get away with it, he did whatever he could. Remember, before then, one of his primary actions, one of his most famous actions, perhaps, was the encouragement of mass migration of young men from Turkey to Europe. Basically, a massive Muslim invasion of Europe, which resulted in 2015 alone in more than a million young men migrating from Turkey to Germany.
I remember that.
Of course, with the connivance of this ridiculous female dog, if I can use that expression, who called herself Angela Merkel, who was a horrible person who was extolled throughout the world for some unbelievable reasons that I can't figure out.
Okay, so how does this all tie back now with the NGOs in Turkey?
The NGOs are one of his primary tools for mass support of terrorist organizations and terrorist activities throughout Israel and throughout the Middle East in general. It's the government as a whole, Turkey as a whole, in Jerusalem, in Gaza, in Athens, in Nicosia, in all throughout the area. And he uses them not just for terrorist funding, but for terrorist logistics and for many, many other things, all of them nefarious. All of these activities are nefarious. None of them are truly charitable organizations, or almost none of them. And most of them are used directly for channeling funding, whether it be from Turkey itself or from additional sources like Qatar and private donations. There are a lot of, remember, if we can sort of probably misquote Dr. What's his name? From the Middle East Forum, Daniel, whatever, Pipes, sorry.
Pipes, yes.
Dismember.
Yeah.
Only some 25% of Muslims in the world are radicalized. Only means that the number of radicalized Muslims far surpasses the total population of the United States.
Okay. All right. So what needs to be done? We only have about 30 seconds left. How do you want to wrap this up before we go to China?
There's nothing
next
really that needs to be done. We need to what Gantz did was the right thing to do.
Gantz is Israel's defense minister.
He wasn't brave enough to do it extensively enough. He did it to 6. And as I said, the number is probably closer to 600.
All right. So again, Gantz is Benny Gantz is Israel's defense minister today. And when we get back, we're going to be speaking about China, because China is a big player in the world right now, wherever you are in the world, because almost everything is made there today. And we're going to find out more how that's going to affect us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany's but a memory, but in its place the world invented the Phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, and our guest is Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem. We're talking about what's going on in and near the Middle East. We've talked about Russia and the meeting that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett had with Vladimir Putin. We talked about, as well, Syria, and we talked about Turkey, and now we're turning our eyes towards China. China always in the news, and we understand, if you do a search Google search on China in the news, you're going to see that China has been building up for a long time now and is waiting to invade Taiwan by hook or by crook, either more, I don't want to use the word benevolently, but either invade more without an outright war or with an outright war. So here to tell us more about that, we have joining us Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem.
Okay, let's put things into perspective for a moment, okay? First of all, China, the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party definitely wants to take over Taiwan. Their claim is that Taiwan is simply a province that broke away, and therefore it's a question of sovereignty, which is not true, by the way, but that's besides the point. That's their basic claim. They have a geostrategic need to do this, because that's the only way to break out of what's called the First Island Chain. And until they break out of that, they cannot be a world power. So they are not today a world power. They cannot project power in any meaningful sense today. And so takeover of Taiwan is a critical portion of their strategic plans for long term. So the question that needs to be asked now is, well, is this at all realistic? Can they actually do that? And let me try to answer that, because it's a very complex question with many dimensions to it. So let's start with the first thing, a thing that certainly every Israeli will understand, and I suspect that most Americans will as well. For many decades, China had something that they called the one-child policy.
Right.
The practical result of that is that almost all families in China had only one child, and one result of that, for instance, was a mass difference in the numbers of male children and female children. So there's a tremendous shortage of females in China.
Yes.
One of the results of that is that many male children are, what's the opposite of reluctant, are not reluctant to join the army, to join the so-called People's Liberation Army, the PLA. But the result of that is that more than 75% of all members of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese Army, are single sons. In other words, if a son like this dies, the family dies. And family is of paramount importance in Chinese history and Chinese society for the past 5,000 years. So one thing we need to take into account is the Taiwanese have been digging in now for 70 years. If China attempts to attack in the sense that Western news media are proclaiming that they're going to attack, because their Western news media are utterly stupid, the Chinese would have to attack in a D-Day kind of manner with a massive amphibious assault, which would mean that the Chinese would lose probably on the order of 500,000 dead Chinese soldiers. No Chinese government could possibly survive 500,000 families being destroyed, utterly, completely, permanently destroyed. So that's not going to happen. Clearly, there's almost no way the Chinese are going to do a D-Day type assault on the beaches of Taiwan.
Can I just play devil's advocate for one moment, just so people can understand, and myself as well? For a communist government who doesn't value life like we do, and for a government that has billions and billions of people, I would imagine that they wouldn't care. If they had a billion people dead, they wouldn't even care, wouldn't make a dent.
You're not incorrect, but you're misphrasing it. They would not care, depending on who those people are. In other words, if they have to kill off a few million Uyghurs, they certainly don't give a damn. If they have to kill off a few hundred thousand Tibetans, they certainly don't care. But those are not the people in the PLA. Those people are not trained to be soldiers or anything else. They're trod upon. They're decimated. They're genocided.
Okay.
But there's another side to your question, which needs to be addressed and is of critical importance. And that is China constantly talking about taking over Taiwan. I've never heard any Chinese leader talk about taking over the Taiwanese.
Explain.
So the China will, in my estimation, and I've checked this out, I've matched opinions with other analysts throughout the world. I have acquaintances in Philippines, in Australia, etc. No one really seriously believes that they're going to massively attack Taiwan, like I said, as a D-Day type invasion. That does not mean that they will not go in and attempt to annihilate all of the Taiwanese in order to take over Taiwan. Now, how will they do that? Will they do that with poison gas or with biological weapons? Poison gas is very unlikely. Biological weapons is quite likely. Or massive bombing. Massive bombing is probably unlikely because they want the infrastructure in Taiwan. Remember, Taiwan is the number one producer of semiconductors in the world today. Another one of America's really unbelievably stupid things that America has done over the past few decades. They gave up their primary strategic advantage in technology. Taiwan today is the number one producer of semiconductors in the world. The Chinese want that very much in order to compete with America. So massive bombings are probably not the way that they're going to go. They don't want to destroy the infrastructure of Taiwan. They do want to totally annihilate the Taiwanese people, because attempting to integrate them into the Chinese society will be totally impossible.
So you're saying that they want to make a genocide.
In Hong Kong, for instance, in massive arrests and et cetera. So there's no way they can do that with Taiwan as well.
So you're saying that they want to make a genocide against the Taiwanese.
I would say that is the most likely scenario.
That is horrid. Horrid.
Yes.
And
there are a number, by the way, people should remember another point here, that the population of Taiwan and the population of Australia are approximately equal. So we're not talking about a trivial country here.
So, you know, many times, unfortunately, when a genocide is committed by a country against a people, the world doesn't lift a finger, doesn't do anything. America claims...
Have you ever heard of the world ever doing anything against a genocide?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So let me just read you this time, because I did a Google search of China and Taiwan, and then I pressed on the news, and these are from the last 2 days. From 2 days ago, ABC News, China vows no concessions on Taiwan after Biden comments. What were Biden's comments? This is also from 2 days ago. Biden says U.S. has a commitment, unquote, to defend Taiwan if China attacks. I would not rely on that or hold my breath, Taiwan, if I were you. So, you know, I could very well see Biden not doing anything. And if China is smelling weakness on America's side with Biden at the helm. I'm very concerned. In the last,
there's no doubt whatever that China strongly recognizes the unbelievable weakness of the American government. The present American government is the weakest government that America has had for many, many decades, perhaps for a century. And China sees that, perceives that, understands that, and they will act upon that. So, yes, you're right. They definitely are taking Biden into account. As I've said many times, Biden is not only weak, he's also stupid.
And why does China want Taiwan so much?
Sorry?
Why does China want Taiwan so much? We only have a few more seconds.
As I said, it's their only way to break out of the first island chain, which will allow them to project power. Remember at the beginning we talked about why Russia wants to be in Syria in order to project power. Via Latakia. China needs to project power to be a global superpower. They cannot do that today. Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines prevent that. That is their primary goal.
All right. So in the last few seconds that we have, how do you want to wrap everything up? What should we go away with?
I want to just make a trivial comment, which might be interesting, but might be useful to some people. Just this morning, for the first time this winter, I broke out a blanket. So till now, I've been sleeping simply covered by a sheet because it's been it hasn't been cold enough to warrant a blanket. So if anybody's interested in the weather in Jerusalem, the weather here is gorgeous.
Okay, but you have 10 seconds to just wrap up the show, everything that we've talked about. We're going off the air in 10 seconds. Go.
Always remember that any power is only a power if it can project power. If you're just within yourself, you're nothing.
Well, that's something to think about. Something to think about with Israel and Russia and the United States and China, of course. All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem, and thank you all for listening in. Feel free to share our shows and feel free to donate towards the station. We could really use your help. All of us are volunteers here, basically, and we really need your help. So we'll be hoping to see emails from you. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. And thank you, Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem.
Thank you for having me.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com homepage, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.